So this is going to be a complete change of pace, or complete change of topic from the previous presentation, anyway. And thanks very much to Fari for having me here today. So what I'd like to do today is discuss a few aspects of the liquidity regime that's been in operation in Australia for almost a year now. And that's the application of one fairly important part of the Basel III standards, namely the liquidity coverage ratio. So what I want to do is describe some of the features of the LCR regime, liquidity coverage regime, that have emerged over the past year, and some of the market developments that have taken place as a result. And I also talk about some of the information that we at the Reserve Bank have gathered from a related development, which is namely, since the middle of this year, we've got gathering a very large amount of information on asset-backed securities in the local market. So why are we getting that? And that's resulting from the fact that if you want your security to be repo eligible with us, you actually have to provide us with very detailed information. Or if you want it to be usable collateral in our committed liquidity facility, which I'll get to in a minute, you also need to provide us with detailed loan level data and detailed information on the security as a whole. So I'll come to that in a minute, but let me talk first about the LCR. So it's been in full operation in Australia from the beginning of this year. So unlike other regimes, it's been in there in 100% form since the beginning of this year. In 2013, so 2 years ago, banks had a trial run so that a number of the balance sheet and other changes that resulted from the LCR had already started to take place before this year. But by the time we got to the beginning of this year, all banks were meeting their LCR requirement, generally with a reasonable buffer. So what do they have to do that? So if you're to meet your LCR requirement, you have to hold enough high-quality liquid assets to cover your projected net cash outflow, so how much cash is actually likely to leave your bank in a 30-day stress scenario. So first of all, you have to work out how much cash is likely to flow out in a 30-day stress, and enough to cover 30 days of that. And then you have to hold enough high-quality liquid assets to deal with that. Banks are required to calculate and maintain an LCR of at least 100% each day, so i.e. cover more than 30 days' worth of outflows. So in other words, absent severe market disruption, the LCR has to be met at all times, not just at the end of a quarter. So this is not one where there's balance sheet window dressing at the end of a quarter. This has to be met every day. So the banks undertake extensive modelling to project their cash outflows, but there's some inherent unpredictability and lumpiness in these flows, particularly around large deposits, as well as some of their derivative positions. So as a result, all of the banks in Australia have decided to maintain a buffer above 100%. So on average, for the industry, it's been around 120%. So more than quite a bit more than they actually need. And some banks have maintained even larger buffers than that. So to be able to hold that amount of high-quality liquid assets and to meet the LCR, the banks have made changes to both the asset and the liability side of their balance sheet. So on the liability side, over the past couple of years, there's been little change in the aggregate share of deposits funding banks and wholesale funding, but beneath the surfaces, the changes have been greater, much more on the price side than on the quantity side. So liabilities with high runoff rates under the LCR, i.e. the money's like to flow out of your bank in 30 days, such as deposits held by other financial institutions, have been repriced to reflect the fact that they're not particularly attractive forms of funding for a bank. So the competition for that sort of deposit, for a deposit from another financial institution, has not been particularly intense. Indeed, the opposite has often been the case, where banks have been happy to see those less sticky forms of funding leave. In contrast, the competition for deposits with low runoff rates have been particularly intense. So if you're a customer who has a whole bunch of products with the bank, you're particularly attractive to them because it's assumed those deposits are assessed to be stickier, and so the banks are willing to pay up for that. And so we've seen the deposit rates on those more stable form of funding rise. Another development is that term deposits are now actually term deposits. They're not just something which is called term and you can just turn up at any day and get them back whenever you feel like it. So for the most part, term deposits are actually now unbreakable ahead of the maturity date, or at the minimum you have to give at least 1 month's notice. So as I said, in the past, such deposits were often broken ahead of the maturity date with little or no penalty. And similarly, banks have made the pricing of notice of withdrawal accounts more attractive to savers. So you have to tell the bank when you actually want to take your money out in advance. Banks have also sought to increase the average maturity of their wholesale bond funding. So the average maturity of outstanding funding at the moment is around 3.5 years compared to 3 years back in 2011. That doesn't sound all that much, but 6 months is actually quite a long time, quite a large increase. There has been a marked decrease in the use of wholesale funding for maturity of less than 30 days. So that's a particularly unattractive source of funding for a bank, as they need to cover such funding with 100% high quality liquid assets. So they're not going to pay you anything more than what they're getting, what they're earning on those high quality liquid assets on the other side. And that's evident in the yield on 1 month bank bills. So the spread between 1 month bank bills and OIS declined markedly at the beginning of this year and has generally been low and stable ever since. It's almost nothing. At the 1 month maturity, we see more activity in banks buying back bills that have rolled down to a residual maturity of 1 month than we do of issuance. So the banks aren't actually issuing 1 month bills, they're actually mostly buying back paper which has 1 month left to maturity. On the asset side, there have also been a number of changes. However, unlike on the liability side, many of these changes took place well ahead of the LCR coming into force at the beginning of this year, and we haven't seen too many more changes take place over the past year. So the most notable change has been the increased holdings of high-quality liquid assets by banks. So in Australia, for a security to be eligible as high-quality liquid assets, it has to be either Commonwealth or state government paper. Because we don't actually have that much of it, of government paper in Australia, the government debt in Australia, the Reserve Bank provides for a fee of 15 basis points per annum this committed liquidity facility to address that shortfall in high-quality liquid assets. So assets which can be used to access this committed liquidity facility are assets which are eligible in our market operations. So let me show you what's happened. I can work out how to do this. No, that's not it. The arrow probably works. So this shows the increase. So what I've got here is how much of Commonwealth and state debt is held by the banking sector. So what you can see here is that increased mostly in 2013 and 2014, ahead of the introduction of the LCR in 2015. It's been pretty much stable since. So currently banks hold just over a quarter of the stock on issue. Now the reason why it's that number is because it's our assessment, the bank's assessment. If the banks were to try and hold much more of that stock, liquidity in the market would run the risk of being impaired. So while it's impossible to be exact in determining where exactly that threshold is, we don't want to find out the hard way that we've set the required holdings too high and market functioning is impaired. So while the overall share of government paper held within that overall share, though, the share held in state government debt is actually much higher than it is in the Commonwealth's debt. And so APRA's having the discussion with banks about how they determine how much they hold in state versus Commonwealth government debt at the moment. So government paper comprises around 40% of the bank's high-quality liquid assets, and the CLF makes up the remainder of the debt of their most of the remainder of their liquid assets. So you can see the second bar, second from the left, is Commonwealth government debt, or Australian government debt, as it's now called, and then the third bar from the left is state government debt. They actually hold some cash with us, which is high-quality liquid asset too. And that's the one on the left, as well as currency. And then the committed liquidity facility on the far right is accounts for the rest of it, which is around 55% of the total. So how do we come up with that size of the committed liquidity facility? So it's determined by APRA each year as the difference between a bank's projected cash outflows. So I mentioned earlier, they have to work out how much cash is going to flow out in a 30-day period, and the amount of HQLA that they can reasonably hold. So basically, it's the difference between their projected cash outflows and the sum of the three bars on the left. So that's worked out annually, depending on how banks' balance sheets change and how much the stock of debt actually changes as well. So over the course of 15, both projected net cash outflows went down and the stock of debt on issue actually went up. So as a result, the banking system's Australian dollar liquidity needs has actually gone down. And for this, for next year, it's assessed by APRA to be about $450 billion. In 2015, it was assessed by APRA to be $450 billion. we at the Reserve Bank thought that the banks could reasonably hold about $175 billion of government securities. Next year, the outflows have fallen from 450 down to 440 billion. So this has gone down even as banks' balance sheets have expanded. And that's because banks have sought to reduce their net cash outflows by the adjustments to the liabilities that I talked about earlier. At the same time, based on Commonwealth and state government budgets, we project that the stock of debt securities that the banks can reasonably hold will rise by about $20 billion by the end of next year. So as a result, the size of the CLF goes down from $275 billion down to $245 billion. So the bar on the right shows the size of the CLF. What assets do the banks use to access it? And this is what this graph shows. So this is the collateral that they hold on their balance sheets to potentially access the CLF. So you can see there that the largest bar is the one third from the right, from the left, which is self-securitized assets. That's asset-backed securities that the banks hold on their own balance sheet. They're not sold into the market. The bar second from the left is asset-backed securities, which would have been issued by another financial institution, which is held on the bank balance sheet of a particular bank. One on the left is basically bank paper, and then there's a few other bits and pieces on the right. So as you can see, the bulk of the eligible collateral is self-securitized assets. And again, APRA and the banks have a continual discussion about the composition of this collateral. These assets, as I said, are held on the balance sheets of the banks. They're not held on our balance sheet. So they're not pre-positioned, as sometimes happens in other jurisdictions, on the balance sheet of the central bank. Moreover, the assets are subject to a haircut in terms of the amount of liquidity they can potentially generate. For example, the haircut on a self-securitized mortgage-backed security is typically more than 20%. So that means if you've got $100 of such a security, then you can get, you can potentially access no more than $80 worth of liquidity from us. In contrast, if you've got $100 worth of an Australian government security, you get $100 worth of liquidity if you sell it in the market. So while such assets generally reside on the balance sheet of an individual bank, in stress circumstances when the CLF is actually activated, the assets get repoed to us. And so to manage this contingent risk on our balance sheet, it's important that we have very detailed information about the quality of such assets, and also that we're able to price them accurately to determine the amount of liquidity we'd potentially provide against them. So to enhance the information available to us, since the middle of this year, it's been mandatory for institutions to report various amounts of information to us for their securities to be eligible or to, in our repo operations, and also to be eligible collateral for the CLF. So the required information includes transactional level data, detailed tranche information, the relationship between mortgage-backed trusts and service providers. So at the loan level, that includes sort of 62 loan fields such as loan balances, interest rates, arrears, 18 borrower fields such as borrower income, employment type, whether you're an investor or an owner-occupier, whether you're a first home buyer, and also details on the collateral, which is mostly just the house, which is its postcode and the property valuation. So these requirements include data that are commonly used already by rating agencies and MBS investors, but the data go quite a fair way beyond that to also include some useful information that has not been commonly compiled, such as offset balances and borrower income at the time of the mortgage origination. So this allows us, along with other investors, to undertake a richer analysis of such securities and more accurately assess their risk and pricing than may have been possible before. It also allows us at the bank to undertake our own risk assessment and not depend on that from a rating agency. So in addition to these data fields, issues are also to provide much more information about the cash flow waterfall model of the security, which gives us a lot more information about the structural aspects of these asset-backed securities than we had in the past. The innovation has also been useful in standardising information across securities. So there wasn't an industry standard out there before, which allows us to make sure that it allows us to more accurately price them by comparing them to securities that are actually in the market. So these reporting information requirements are standardised for all asset-backed securities, meaning that the same information is required for all of them. As a result, going forward, it will be much easier for us and for others and investors to compare securities. And the industry, by and large, has been fairly supportive of this throughout the whole process. The repo eligibility requirements also direct issuers to make the information available to investors and other permitted users, not just the Reserve Bank. So by and large, the information provided to these groups is pretty much the same as that provided to us, but there have been some fields where the information provided posed a potential risk to privacy. So after a few conversations with the Privacy Commissioner, it's resulted in the fact that the issuers may redact some particular fields to stop you being able to identify whose loan it is you're actually looking at in this database. Since the middle of this year, when this information requirement came in, we've received around 1,600 submissions from financial institutions covering around $400 billion in assets and providing us with information around 2 million individual housing loans, which is a decent chunk of the housing loans out there in the Australian economy. The information gets updated to us on a monthly frequency, so we're not only getting a snapshot of the mortgage market at any point in time, we're actually going to get quite a large panel data series fairly quickly. So we'll be able to examine how the market and the underlying collateral evolves through time. With the caveat that the data reporting is still in its infancy, it's already apparent there are quite a large number of benefits of the data. And so I'm just going to show you a few things we know would have been to extract from the database just in the few months that we've had the data. So as I said, these data cover around 2 million housing loans. There are about 6 million housing loans out there in the economy as a whole. So we've got about one third of information on one third of those. So this graph shows you the loan to valuation ratio at origination, so this is the top panel, and what they are currently. So not surprisingly, with house prices going up at least and loans being paid down, the loan to valuation ratio currently is lower than it is at origination. And then you can see there at origination in particular, a large chunk of housing loans have a loan to valuation ratio between 70 and 80%. And one reason why there's a big drop-off after 80%, for those of you who've got a home loan, probably might know this one, then you need mortgage insurance if your loan-to-valuation ratio is above 80%. So there's a very large number of loans bunched in that 70 to 80, probably a decently large number with a loan-to-valuation ratio of 79%. So it's also very clear from that you know, as of today, that these things amortise reasonably quickly or that house prices go up. So the current loan-to-valuation ratio, if you look in the bottom panel, there's very few after a few years which have an LVR greater than 90%. So the next thing I can show you is what's called seasoning. So it's got nothing to do with pepper and salt, but it just means that once you've got a mortgage out there, you don't stick it into a mortgage-backed security on day one. You hold it on your books for a little while just to see how it goes. And then after a little bit of time, you stick it into a mortgage-backed security. So there's very few, less than 5% of mortgages in a mortgage-backed security which have been originated less than a year ago. And the bulk of them are originated between 2 and 4 years. So the bank holds them on their balance sheet for a while, sees how that goes, and then packages them up into a mortgage-backed security. So, as I said, more than three quarters of the loans in your average mortgage-backed security have been originated more than 3 years ago. So one issue which is of some interest currently is the extent of the repayment buffer that has been built up by borrowers. And so we can actually use this database to try and get some information on that. So again, for those of you who've got a mortgage, you can build up a repayment buffer a few ways. One way you can do it is by putting money into your offset account. Another way is you actually prepay your mortgage faster than the required repayment schedule. And so what we show here is how far people are on average ahead on their mortgages in terms of how many months worth of payment are you ahead. And you can see the top part of the top bar part of the bars is people have built up a buffer of more than 12 months. So that means they can effectively go, they've got more than enough money sitting there, they're more than 12 months ahead on their mortgage. They could go without making more monthly payments for 12 months and not fall behind on the mortgage. And you can see there, for at the moment at least for the major banks, more than 75% are at least 1 month ahead on their mortgage. Obviously, if you've only just taken out your mortgage, you're probably not ahead straight away. So as this as we get a more of a time series on this, we can it actually has potential to be quite useful information in our assessment of monetary policy, because we can see how these repayment buffers move up and down through the monetary policy cycle. And it's also obviously useful for financial stability considerations. Another thing we can also look at is the share of low doc mortgages, which attracted a bit of attention about 8 years ago or so. And you can see for the major banks, they basically don't write low doc mortgages. And most of the low doc mortgages are written by the non-banks, so the people on the right-hand side of this graph, mostly because it's actually a market segment that they tend to target. Finally, in terms of credit risks, we can also look at arrears by state. And so this shows from the data we've got at the moment what the current situation in terms of arrears. So you can see here that the arrears obviously vary by state. So this is as of today. So with New South Wales probably doing the best over the last year or two, arrears in this state are actually lower than they are in some of the other states. And then in WA, perhaps not particularly surprisingly, they're a bit higher than they are in some of the other states at the moment. So those are actually reasonably consistent with the variation in recent economic performance across states, though the other thing to note is that the overall arrears rate is actually pretty low. Of course, credit risk is not so much about the average, but also the distributions. And so having the loan level data enables an insight into the characteristics of the loans and the various tails of the distribution that warrant close attention. So as I said, the averages tell you something, but to some extent, particularly when it comes to assessing the riskiness of the securities, is as much you want to know as much about what's going on in the tails as you do about the average. But in sum, there is very rich potential in these data for many purposes for the RBA and other market participants. From our point of view, the data provide us with a great deal of insight into the contingent risk that at some point might reside on our balance sheet, hopefully at no point, but at some point it might. But clearly, the data are also very useful for financial stability and monetary policy considerations too. So I said that this is the first cut we've had of this data. We've only had it for a few months, but it gives you some idea about the sort of information you can extract from it. To conclude, so as we approach 1 year of the full implementation of the LCR in Australia, it's worth looking at some of the changes that have occurred. There's been a repricing of liabilities, mostly deposits, to reflect the differences in their treatment under the LCR. And on the asset side, banks are now holding more government paper than they did a few years ago. The banking system contingent use of the CLF will actually decrease next year from where it was this year, as banks have continued to make adjustments to lower their net cash outflows and increase their resilience to funding shocks. This has occurred even as bank balance sheets have continued to expand. So while the LCR is now well established in the local market, another Basel acronym for you, the Net Stable Funding Ratio, or NSFR, is yet to be implemented. The NAPRA will be consulting on this in the new year. That's also likely to have an impact on the composition of bank balance sheets beyond what we've had from the LCR. The enhanced reporting of information on asset-backed securities that commenced in the middle of this year is providing us and other market participants with a wealth of standardised information. It is allowing us to enhance our risk assessment of our contingent liability under CLF, providing us with very granular insight into the collateral that we're potentially holding. The data are beneficial not only for this reason, but also have the potential to inform assessments of financial stability and provide insight into one important transmission channel of monetary policy, namely that which runs through the mortgage market. So as I said, we have information on one third of the mortgages which are out there in the economy. We're getting monthly updates on that information. And so in a fairly short period of time, we'll have quite an incredibly rich panel data set, which will provide a lot of insight to us in terms of how monetary policy actually flows through into the economy as a whole. So let me finish there, and happy to take any questions that that people might have. So you're going to have to have it. Yep, down the front here.
Did the Australian banks maintain 100% LCR 2015? And another question, do the banks report the LCR so daily or monthly?
So they as I said earlier, on average it's 120, and some banks hold more than that. They report them to APRA. They report them to APRA every day. They do their reporting in their quarterly profit updates. You can find that they've been doing that, I think, for at least a year now. So it's reported publicly on a quarterly frequency in their regular profit updates, but it's provided to APRA every day.
Thanks.
So, over here.
About a year ago, we had a report, Tollip's reports, indicating that the house prices in Australia are 30% undervalued.
Under or over?
Overvalued.
Okay.
And then we have a Nobel Prize winner, Vernon Smith, invited to Macquarie University, indicating that the Australian property market is entering a bubble.
Mm.
And now we have also... today, there was some of the ABS data on the rent indices and clearly indicating that house price to rent ratio, in fact, the rents are falling, house prices are slowing. And the other observation, before I ask my question, was that we can realize that during the last couple of months, we see that the share of the owner's occupier's loans is continue to rise, whereas the investment loans has showing some sign of easing and falling to some extent. Now, what is your opinion on the recent increasing the liquidity has pushed the interest rates, the standard variable mortgage rates, high, and to what extent we can relate the rise in owner occupier to these interest rate differentials? In other words, my question is this a rise in owner-occupiers' loans real owner-occupiers, or is it investor loans appearing in the form of owner-occupiers just simply because they want to pay lower interest rate? Thank you.
So some of it's that. If you're paying, investors have to at the moment pay about 25 basis points more than an owner-occupier. So yes, some investors have now decided that they are living in the place that they previously recorded as an investment, and have decided that they're an owner-occupier than an investor. That's not the full story, but there has indeed been some switching. So the person hasn't switched; they've just decided to call themselves an owner-occupier now rather than an investor. One of the other things which has gone on is that some of the banks have switched them unilaterally by looking at the address on the property and lining that up against where they send the mortgage bill to. And if the two things are the same thing, they say, well, you're probably an owner-occupier, not an investor, which is very generous of them, because it means they get 25 basis points less of interest. But so, yes, there is some of that switching going on. In terms of the flow, as best as we can tell, there's also investor lending is actually slowing above and beyond just people switching categories, but it's still there. It's just not growing as fast as it was earlier in the year. No, right down the back.
Thanks, Guy. Adam Crichton from The Australian. Just two quick questions. Firstly, is there any sense in which the deterioration of the Commonwealth government actually makes it easier for banks to satisfy these liquidity requirements? And then secondly, if the Federal Reserve raises rates overnight, what sort of impacts do you expect in Australian financial markets?
Stuff will happen. I've answered this question about five times in the past 5 months. And stuff will probably happen beyond the fact, as Glenn said again this morning, and I've said before, this is the most telegraphed rate rise in the history of rate rises. And you have been, no one can say that they haven't been warned that this is coming. So, but nevertheless, I'm sure stuff will probably happen. What stuff, don't know. We'll see tomorrow. On your first question, though, yes, if there's a bit more government debt, we determine, it's not an absolute number, it's a share of the stock outstanding in terms of what we assess the banks can actually hold without impairing the liquidity in the market. So if there's more debt on issue, then there's more than the banking system can hold more of that. same share, just a higher absolute number. That said, some of the state government budget numbers are, not all, but some are coming out the other way. So, and in the general scheme of things, an extra 10 or 15 billion worth of debt, is that's not a big number, and you know, doesn't make, you know, relative to the sort of required holdings they have of about 400 billion. So it adds a few billion, but it's not a sort of first order change. Got time for one more if anyone wants to go down that route. Yeah, Farry.
We just one and two here. In terms of comparison with what we've done with LCR to other countries, are there any lessons learned? Are there any comparative studies to see how similar economies have implemented LCRs? And the second issue here is when we provide facilities to banks as Reserve Bank of Australia, is there any implication for the Reserve Bank's own liquidity over time, or is not much correlation?
I mean, for our, sorry, yeah. No, I think, I mean, on the first question, so not everyone, I don't think everyone has actually fully implemented them. Some of them have been phased in a bit. I mean, it's fully there in the US, and I'm pretty sure in the UK and a number of other countries too, but in Europe I think it's still on a bit of a phasing process. But also the situation here is different from, I mean, in the US at the moment it's not hard for the banks to meet their LCR requirements because the Fed's balance sheet is so large. That's actually, it's pretty easy. And that's similar in Europe and Japan as well. So if the central bank's balance sheet is that large and the banks, relative to the size of the economy and the size of the banking system, then the banks are holding deposits with the central bank, which are definitionally high-quality liquid assets. So it's just much easier for them to actually to get there. So, so the sort of macro circumstances in a number of these countries actually affect the degree to which it makes it easy or not for the banks to comply. But, you know, this has only been in for a year or so, and so it's probably a little too early to get into cross-country comparisons, but there are some fundamental differences in the as much of the macroeconomic situation of a number of these, a number of other countries, to which affect the degree to which this is actually having an impact. All right, I'd call it quits there. Oh, no, I can't either, actually, so I'm blinded
by the light.
Anyone else? But I'm happy to leave it there.
Okay, thank you very much. Please join me in saying a big thank you to Guy. Thank you.